From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the stunning reversal by leaders of the LDS Church on a polarizing policy that had declared same-sex couples apostates and kept their children from church membership. For whatever reason, a press release announced yesterday the church was rolling back the policy. And in Mormon circles, this is a big deal. Some are taking the news with joy and relief. Others are saying it's just too little, too late. We'll be right back.
My name is Daisha Eaton. I am a reporter covering religion and social justice for KUER. I became interested in public radio because I realized in listening how powerful it is to hear someone else's story through their voice. It is beyond anything you can do through the written word.
Help KUER bring the stories that matter to your state. Make a contribution today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The press release that came from the Mormon Church's public affairs department yesterday kind of backed into the big news. It started by mentioning the coming LDS General Conference this weekend, and then a quote from Church President Russell Nelson saying the last year had brought revelation upon revelation. So far, nothing new. And then this at around paragraph 3, a quote from Dallin Oaks, one of the members of the church's governing first presidency. Here's what he said. "While the church cannot change the Lord's doctrine, we want our members and our policies to be considerate of those struggling with the challenges of mortality." And what he means by the challenges of mortality in this case is homosexuality. And the policy he was referring to was one in particular that came in November of 2015. It officially designated same-sex couples as apostates. But the part that really caused a stir was the part of the policy that said the children of these couples could not be baptized. They couldn't be blessed as children. They could go to church if they wanted to, but they wouldn't be members, not officially. And the only way they could be members was if later in their lives, when they became, I think it was 18, they officially had to renounce their parents' relationship. So then, a few more paragraphs later, came the news that surprised and shocked most everyone. Effective immediately, that policy was being reversed, it said. Children could be members. Their parents wouldn't be apostates anymore, though Oaks made it clear sexual relations by same-sex couples was still sin, a serious transgression, he called it. The reaction, as you can imagine, has been mixed. Just looking at the tweets, there were those who expressed gratitude and deep emotion that God had changed this policy. But others, of course, were more skeptical, like this tweet from the post-Mormon podcast Zelf on the Shelf. "The coldness of this reversal," it said, "was like reversing over someone you just hit in your car." Today in the program, we're talking about the news, the reaction, what this all means. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is Lee Hale, who reports on religion. He's working on a podcast for KUER. He happens to be in Boston today. That's where he was when the news broke. He's joining us from a studio there. Lee Hale, welcome back to you.
Hey, Doug.
So give us a sense, first of all, we'll get into some details as we go. How big a deal is this?
I can't think of a bigger deal right now. As somebody who's covered the church for a little over 2 years, anyone I've interviewed who is struggling with their membership, this policy usually comes up at some point in the conversation, maybe subtly, maybe overtly. But it was felt by a whole spectrum of members. I mean, of course, it influenced LGBT members, but it also influenced a lot of straight members who were, you know, steadfastly in the church and just could not feel comfortable owning this policy. Just like with most things, as time went on, people kind of got used to it, mm-hmm. It became normal, but they weren't defending it, right? Like, it just became kind of like room temperature, I think. So this, I think, what I saw on Twitter initially yesterday, again, I'm not in Salt Lake, so I was watching this unfold on the internet.
Yeah.
I initially saw a lot of excitement. I saw a lot of just relief, and I saw it from people who I think were just tired of walking that line. That gave way later in the day to the frustration that this is not an apology, the frustration that this doesn't make everything better. And so I was seeing those both kind of happen in real time.
How significant is, I mean, there's this sense that that when Mormon leadership makes changes, significant changes, it goes at this kind of glacial pace. How
right.
How important is it that this thing was turned around in about 3.5 years?
It feels different than what I'm used to. But at the same time, Russell Nelson, the president of the church, is different than what I think everyone who watches the church is used to. He's been president of the church a little over a year. And there's been probably more changed in that year and a half than there was in the 10 years prior of Thomas S. Monson's time as president. So this feels like – it feels different, but also feels like business as usual a little bit with Nelson. He seems like somebody who is not afraid of big announcements. He's not afraid of making a splash. In fact, I think he enjoys it, actually, making some waves and kind of challenging people's preconceived notions. Last year, he has this quote that's been, you know, shared, which he said, you know, if you think that what's happened has been impressive, you know, take your, you know, eat your vitamins, right? Like, basically, more changes on the way. And I think people thought more that was probably referring to structural things with the church. You had 2-hour church from 3-hour church, kind of these things that matter to very believing Mormons, but not to anyone else. A policy change like this, this feels different, though. This feels like you're getting closer to deeper doctrinal views of Mormons. And I'm a little surprised because Nelson and Oakes, his first counselor, who seemed very, very unified in all their decision-making, they seem to really protect especially how the church and how Mormons talk about marriage and how they talk about the sanctity of a man and woman. So they've protected that, but at the same time, Nelson is willing to shake up policy.
What did you see in that that statement that I was referring to earlier, where they talked about how Oakes, again referring to Oakes, he talked about how because I thought it was really interesting. He mentioned they want their members and their policies to be considerate of those struggling. What did that say? Because it wasn't a concession that they had necessarily made a mistake, but it did seem to say that this was an inconsiderate policy. I mean, you could say.
Yeah, and just, I guess, a disclaimer for the whole conversation. It's important to point out they did not use the word mistake. They did not use the word apology, right? This is not what this is.
Yes.
It is interesting that Oakes was the one who penned this, so I guess said it initially to leadership, I guess on Wednesday that would have been, because Oakes has been seen as somebody who can say the most hurtful things. With especially over the General Conference microphone, Oakes, not that long ago, kind of reiterated the proclamation to the family, which is kind of like the church's closest thing to kind of like a doctrinal statement on gender and why homosexuality is not correct and why it's a sin. So it is strange that, I mean, a lot of people might look at that at Oakes specifically and say he doesn't actually care about being considerate. He doesn't care about convenience. He doesn't care whether it's easy for you to participate and believe in this church because it's, you know, it's Jesus Christ Church. So this is a different tone from him a little bit. But yeah, the wording is important. This is not a concession. This is still under the Revelation umbrella as far as the brethren or the church leaders are concerned. That, you know, the policy was initially Revelation. Now this revoking it is Revelation. It has a lot of people scratching their heads, rightfully so.
Yeah.
But yeah.
We'll dig into that as we go because I think that's an important point. Let me get a few more voices involved in the conversation as we go. Greg Prince is joining us. He's an independent historian. He has a new book called Gay Rights in the Mormon Church, Intended Actions, Unintended Consequences. He lives in Maryland. He's in St. George, actually, though, today. He's joining us from Radio Dixie on the campus of Dixie State University. And Gregory Prince, welcome back to you.
Good morning, Doug. Nice to be here again.
Troy Williams is joining us in studio, Executive Director of Equality Utah, which advocates for LGBTQ issues in the state. And Troy, welcome back to you.
Hi.
So I wanted to begin just to talk a little bit about, and Greg Prince, I want to hear you on this. It requires, of course, some speculation to talk about how the November 2015 policy played out in the first place, but because we're not sure about the inner workings of the governing First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve. It's usually concealed from the public. But there's been some indication that not everyone in church leadership was exactly thrilled by that policy and how it came about. Can you say anything about that?
I can say a little bit. I think you have to back up to June of 2015 to get the context for the policy. And that was when the Supreme Court decided in the case of Obergefell versus Hodges that same-sex marriage would now be the law of the land. this created a shockwave, particularly in Utah. And I talked to several of the general authorities later after the policy was announced, and they all said, yes, the policy was a direct response, a direct consequence of the Supreme Court decision. What it meant was that the church, for the first time, had to acknowledge the legality of same-sex marriage and yet somehow do a balancing act between that reality and its own standards regarding sexual conduct. What I heard, what a lot of people heard, was that contrary to the usual way that serious policies in the church are vetted and discussed, sometimes for months or even years, this one went through in a hurry, and it didn't go through all of the channels that one would have expected. As a result, public affairs was caught flat-footed, that they knew about it the morning that it was announced, and so they were not prepared for the type of rollout that one would expect from what is generally a fairly fine-tuned operation that they have.
Because the original rollout was so controversial, there was some speculation by some that this was not going to last. But not long after, and this was something that Lee was talking about, President Nelson, he wasn't president then, but Russell Nelson, Elder Russell Nelson, actually president of the Quorum of the Twelve, so the senior leader in that body, he gave this speech which said that the November policy was not just a policy, but it was a revelation. What's the significance of that? Because that seemed, again, people are sort of scratching their heads, as Lee said, about this idea of what's revelation then?
Well, I think you have to look, again, at a sequence of events. In November, you had the announcement of the policy. By December, there seemed to be fissures developing in the facade, that there were some church leaders at a high level who were saying, look, this is a policy, it's temporary, it will change soon. Then in January, you had Russell Nelson speaking in Hawaii on a satellite broadcast, and apparently without any of his colleagues having been aware of the content of his remarks in advance, playing the revelation card, saying, no, this is not a policy, this is a revelation. Trying to read between the lines, what I see is that this was a successful attempt to stop the leaks. On the other hand, when you play that card, you're playing a card that even though it's an integral part of the Mormon faith and theology, it's not played publicly very often. And so it puts a very, very high bar into place that hadn't been in place previously. And people were suddenly thinking, are we ever going to be able to reverse this now that this has been termed a revelation?
Did you hear that, Lee, from from people that, like, there's no backing down now?
Well, and I thought they took it a step further. I mean, revelation is a big word. Nelson is comfortable using that word. And that's kind of what makes him interesting in the way he leads. But also, I did some reporting about when they included it in Preach My Gospel, the main manual for missionaries, they included the new policy there. And I believe in a seminary manual, so seminary meaning the religious class that teenagers take. And so that felt even more interesting to me, speaking of like how the policy going into the future, because these are tangible manuals, right? And Mormons understand the significance of manuals with the church's name on the back. Like, that's a big part of what it means to be Mormon, is you adhere to the manuals. And so I saw that as them kind of putting their foot down and saying, this isn't going anywhere. So that's why this was especially surprising to me, is because I thought that now they have to reprint these manuals, right? There's a logistical cost there, which is, I'm sure, the least of their concern. But I just thought that was an interesting thing to decide just months before this.
I wanted to get to the reaction and the effects. Troy Williams, where were you when you heard about the policy in November of 2015?
I was in a bar in Boys Town in Chicago, which is kind of like the little gay part of town. And I was at a conference, and my phone started blowing up, and it was Fox News, and it was KSL, and I'm like, I'm not answering it. And then it kept happening, and then I'm like, oh, something bad has happened in Utah, and I need to figure this out. When I saw what it was, when I read the policy and I saw the leaked information on Facebook, I walked outside and I just started crying, because I knew the impact this was going to have on our community. In particular, Latter-day Saint families with LGBTQ family members. I knew this would drive this wedge. And keep in mind, this was the same year where just a few months before, I had stood with Elder Perry and Elder Christofferson with this historic Utah Compromise, the first time LGBTQ folks were included in the legal fabric of our state on such a fantastic, wonderful event. And so I just felt punched in the gut, and I worried about the impact on our families.
Yeah. So how did you react when the reversal came?
Well, I was driving on my vacation to Moab, yeah. And my phone blew up in Price, and so I had to pull over in the parking lot. There was this surge of relief and gratitude and joy and yet also hurt and upset. And I wear a couple different hats. And I'm the director of Equality Utah, so I represent that organization. But I'm also a gay guy that grew up in the church, served a mission for the church, and have felt the fissures in my family over these issues. So it's really navigating all kinds of complicated emotions.
Yeah. Lee Hale, that must be what you're hearing as well. On one hand, people feeling grateful and joyful, but there's then the other part of them, like Troy, that feels like, wait a minute, this doesn't really change some things. It doesn't really fix some things.
Yeah. Well, and Troy specifically, I was watching you online yesterday kind of being the diplomat, because obviously you said you wear hats. And
yeah.
I think that I saw you do something other people did, which is don't, you know, there obviously is rightful frustration here, but you also do want to validate the fact that people have been asking for this policy to go away, and now it went away.
Yeah.
And so that is you got to say that was a response, right? And we talk about, just recently on the show, we talked about activism in the LDS Church and how they're not going to give the activists credit for change, but you have to see the connection. And I see people like Troy, and I see other people raising their voice, and I think, well, they listened.
Did they listen? Do you think, Troy?
Yeah, I mean, I've been working with the church, you know, nonstop. I mean, we meet with them regularly, and you know, Mama Dragons and Mormons Building Bridges, the Encircle House, they're all actively meeting with the church, and I want to give them credit for that. They don't have to. And when you look at conservative states across the country, they're not having the level of success that we are in Utah. Yeah. Just this week, Governor Herbert, with much fanfare, we had a great ceremony signing an LGBTQ inclusive hate crimes law. And this is the third time in 4 years that Governor Herbert has signed an LGBTQ inclusive bill. That's not happening in Texas or Kentucky or North Carolina, but it's happening here in Utah. And a big credit goes to the church for engaging with groups like Equality Utah.
Greg Prince, what do you think about that? How much influence do you think this sort of engagement or activism by other groups played in all of this, as far as you can tell?
I think the loudest voice is the sound of feet walking away from the church. And we heard that voice to the tens of thousands in the aftermath of this policy. Some people who had already withdrawn from church activity but said, I never took the step of resigning my membership formally. This has driven me to that. One of the most prominent was Kate Kendall, who was the executive director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights. Lifelong Mormon, had withdrawn from activity decades earlier, but she said this was the final straw. So you had that. You also had the effects being seen of families that were being ripped apart, of a spike in suicides. None of that plays well to people of goodwill. And I think that the brethren in the leadership of the church are good men who are trying to do the right thing. When you have this kind of corrective coming back at you, I think it's impossible to ignore it forever.
Any way of measuring numbers, as far as you can tell? Any have you seen any figures as to being able to quantify how many people may have left or been affected by this?
There are no published figures, but I heard, I think on very good authority from somebody who worked within the church office building, that in the year following the announcement of the policy, over 60,000 people formally resigned their memberships. We have no idea how many people just backed out without going through that form of policy. There was one stake president in the Salt Lake Valley who, in a stake meeting, a public worship service, announced that nearly 10% of the membership of that stake had formally resigned their membership over the policy. Those are pretty scary numbers.
So do you think, Lee Hale, I want to hear all of you on this question, actually. Was there a sense, do you think, that they, I don't know how you could tell this, but they had to do something?
Well, and kind of to Greg's point, too, I would add that activity in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a spectrum.
Yeah.
And there's lots of ways that leaders can sense that members are becoming less devoted. And these can be members still going to church on Sunday, but maybe they don't have a temple recommended anymore. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're not accepting a calling, a responsibility in their congregation. Maybe they're not showing up to all 3 hours or now 2 hours of church. Like, the church is very aware of those. I mean of those factors. And I, just as a religion reporter, sense that, as I talk to people who aren't willing to revoke their membership, but there was less excitement, there was less energy. And I look at President Nelson as somebody who wants people to be excited. That is very clear. He wants people to feel energized. And if this is the elephant in the room or the weight on the shoulders, this would probably be kind of raining on his party a little bit as far as, like, getting people excited about the changes happening in his church. And I could see him viewing this as something that was kind of, I guess, had to be addressed just by the tone and the feeling alone, and kind of what Oak's statement kind of speaking to, the awareness that this has been a pain point for families especially.
What do you think?
I want to give a shout out to the incredible Mormon allies who have rallied on behalf of our community over the past few years. The emergence of Mormons Building Bridges, Mama Dragons, the Encircle House, Love Loud. I have had such a surge of love and support from the Latter-day Saint community, and they have been rallying in huge numbers on our behalf. And so I want to send them so much love and gratitude for stepping up, seeing this injustice, and then stepping up to rectify it. That speaks to the very best of Latter-day Saint values, to love one another, to mourn with those who mourn.
Yeah. Lee, go ahead.
Sorry for cutting you off.
No, no.
Troy, I was curious about another thing that I didn't mention, but Troy, I wonder if you get a sense of active members who have, in confidence of their bishop, gone and talked about the anxieties of this, because I think I imagine that would trickle up eventually.
I hear stories. I mean, for a while there, it was on a weekly basis of members of the church reaching out to me, apologizing on behalf of the church, and confiding in us, letting me know that they've left the church because of this. It happens so frequently, I can't even keep track of it. And I think that's, at the end of the day, as I've been talking to our LGBT community, there's relief and gratitude that the policy has been reversed. But, oh, there is a yearning for a genuine apology. And this is a big thing. How do we heal? How do we truly heal this divide? When I was a kid growing up in primary, the church taught me how to repent. When I'd hurt somebody, you have to first recognize that you hurt somebody, feel remorse. If you can, make restitution, and then resolve never to do that again. That's what the church taught me. Those are values that I still live by today. And it hurts our community that leaders of the church can't do that. Are unwilling to do that. And if church leaders are listening right now, I'm asking you on behalf of so many people that are hurt right now, please live the fullness of your gospel and ask for our forgiveness. We'll give it to you.
Here's a tweet that comes from Cheryl Holdaway that expresses a similar kind of sentiment. She writes in a tweet from yesterday, I think it was, "Well, they can't just take back all the pain and destroyed relationships and youth suicides, especially with a cold and stoic press release given without any apology." Greg Prince, I don't want to put you in the position of raining on Troy's parade, but do you expect any sort of apology? It doesn't seem to be the thing that church leaders do.
Not only have we not heard apologies historically, but President Oakes, on at least one occasion, said in a public forum, "We do not apologize. We will not apologize," as a general statement. Let me make comment about comparing this policy and its reversal to Proposition 8, because they're clearly linked. But I think the greater damage of Proposition 8 in 2008 was external, that it branded the church as homophobic in the public mind to the point where many referred to Proposition 8 as the Mormon proposition. So there was some serious external damage control that was necessary. One of the manifestations of an attempt to try to control that damage was in the months later when the church surprisingly backed a Salt Lake City ordinance that protected gays from discrimination in housing and employment. I think the major difference with the policy was that the effect externally was minimal, but the effect internally was devastating and permanent. And that's what we're seeing now. Yes, it made the headlines yesterday, but I think this is a story that in the national press is not likely to last more than one or two news cycles. Internally is where this is really going to make a difference.
Yeah.
That's Gregory Prince. He's the author of the new book, Gay Rights in the Mormon Church, Intended Actions, Unintended Consequences. We also have with us here in the studio Troy Williams, Executive Director of Equality Utah. Lee Hale is in Boston right now. He's working on a new religion podcast for KUER. He's also joining us. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER's community calendar is a resource where you can find hundreds of events happening across Utah. You can learn a new skill in workshops, experience art and performances offered across the state, scout family-friendly events and activities, and a whole lot more. You can also share your own events. Just fill out the form. It's all on our website, KUER.org. Just click Community Calendar under the Events tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the really stunning reversal by leaders of the LDS Church on a polarizing policy that had declared same-sex couples apostates, kept the children from church membership. For whatever reason, a press release announced yesterday the church was rolling back that policy, so that's what we're talking about today. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We have with us Lee Hale of KUER. He's joining us from Boston. Gregory Prince is with us. He's the author of a new book on the subject, actually, Gay Rights in the Mormon Church, Intended Actions, Unintended Consequences is the title. And Troy Williams is with us here in the studio, Executive Director of Equality Utah. Let's take a call. This is Clinton, who's joining us from Salt Lake City. Clinton, welcome.
Thanks for having me on your program. So my comment is, we keep on referring to this as a policy and a policy change, and it was made very clear by President Nelson 3 years ago that this was a revelation, not a policy. And it made it clear that this is now another revelation. So 1,246 days ago, God made up his mind one way, and now yesterday, God changed his mind. And I think that's a really hard pill for those of us that are in this community that have been raised Mormon to swallow. And I think it's an important part of the conversation, especially for people that are not members or don't understand what a revelation means in religion.
Yeah. That's a good point. I actually want to talk about that. And we should sort of put in perspective, this was something that Greg Prince was mentioning earlier, how Russell Nelson had given this speech. It was a televised speech in Hawaii to the church's young adults. And he explained basically how leaders make these kinds of decisions. And he talked about how the leaders after this policy went to the temple. They counseled together, he said. They prayed to see if this November policy was God's will. And he described it as a sacred moment, and that all had felt what he called a spiritual confirmation that this policy, this controversial policy, was God's will, and that it was a revelation, he said. And this is a quote. He said, "It was our privilege as apostles to sustain what had been revealed to President Monson." Greg Prince, Lee, did you want something to say before we get to Greg?
I'll say quickly that the vocab game with this is interesting. I mean, when we're talking about revelation or doctrine, you talk to different people, they'll tell you different definitions for each, you know. And I'll just point out that Oakes in the statement yesterday said, while we cannot change the Lord's doctrine, we want our members and policies to be more considerate. So he's now labeling it as not doctrine, that revelation can be something other than doctrine. And yeah, I'm curious what Greg has to say about that, because I hear different definitions of these all the time.
Yeah, Greg Prince, what do you make of that? Was this God's will then and now God's will now? Because that's how they often explain the revelation that came in 1978 that removed the ban of blacks receiving the priesthood.
I'm a little reluctant to speak on behalf of God, so let me sidestep it a little bit. But there are four words that mean different things to different people, particularly within the context of Mormonism. Revelation on the one hand, inspiration on the other, doctrine on the one hand, policy on the other. And any given thing could mean one of those words to somebody and another one of those words to somebody else. Let me give you an example. When the issue of the black policy on priesthood, when blacks of African origin were not allowed to be ordained to the priesthood for over a century, David O. McKay was the first church president that we're aware of who privately but actively challenged the status quo. He never called it a doctrine. He was very careful. He was an English major, so he knew about the value of words. He always called it a policy, and in private conversations even said it's a policy that will change, but he said it will take a revelation to change it, which is an interesting juxtaposition of those two words. And I think what he meant was that this couldn't be done simply by an administrative act because there were too many minds that had to be changed that couldn't be changed without this supernatural power sweeping over them. I think that's what we have to keep in mind here, that revelation may not necessarily be specific words saying this is the doctrine. It may be like a wave sweeping over the room to convince people that whatever they were doing before is now going to be changed.
Hmm. This was interesting. Jana Reese, the historian, religion scholar, wrote a piece that was published in today's Salt Lake Tribune, and she says, the policy of reversal demonstrates that robust discussions continue at the highest levels and that President Nelson is not afraid to alter the church's course, even if doing so seems to destabilize his own previous statements. She says it also suggests any policy is subject to modification and perhaps abandonment, even if it's previously been heralded as a revelation from God. What do you think about that?
I think that in a church that has made its bedrock revelation that there's no such thing as an immovable status quo. Hmm. If you look back to the origins of Mormonism in 1830, and even the era slightly before that, where we have some records of where Joseph Smith was going and thinking, I have yet to find a single significant doctrine that has never been changed. And so on the one hand, I think it's important for people to feel that there's stability. On the other hand, I think it's equally important for people in a revelatory church to be able to change when that change comes. I don't know what might be changed. I don't know what the circumstances or the timing would be. But I'm fine with change being the one constant in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Lee Hale?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I hear from a lot of Latter-day Saints is that the most important doctrine is faith, repentance, baptism, right? Kind of what Troy was alluding to, the things you learn in primary as a young child. And I think those Latter-day Saints also get frustrated when policies like this seem to complicate the simpleness of that gospel, right? And so I think for those kind of like meat and potatoes Latter-day Saints who want to keep it simple, keep it focused on Jesus, I think they can be pretty confident that that's not going anywhere. But I think like Jana said, everything else seems like it's up for potential change.
Here's a tweet from Kate Kelly. She's been commenting about this. She's a feminist, an activist who was excommunicated from the LDS Church because of her activism. She wrote this: make no mistake, this is about their bottom line. When it impacts their revenue stream, things move quickly. Greg Prince, does she have a point?
I doubt it. This is a very affluent church, and the church leaders since 1959 have not made public statements quantifying the church's wealth. But if you talk to enough people who are close to the epicenter, the church is very stable financially, and I don't think that they're a bit moved by temporary fluctuations in contributions. I think they're much more attuned, particularly on this issue, to the human cost. What's happening among the members? What has been the effect of this? In the medical realm, we use a term called evidence-based medicine, which is that you'd like to make sure that whatever you're doing medically is backed up by good science, by good observations, that is actually making a difference in the right direction. And I think this is part of the discussion that has probably gone on in this one, that 3 years out, you've got enough evidence to say, is this where we want to stay, or do we need to shift?
Can I push back?
But I don't think that there was a financial incentive to it at
all. Let me push back just a little bit. You don't think that if you look at where the sort of general impression in popular culture is going in terms of its acceptance of you know, rights for LGBTQ people, that the church isn't feeling like it's having some effect, if not on their bottom line, certainly their membership. I mean, don't you think that had to have been part of the motive?
Oh, I think that the metric that was likely being used was look at the membership, look at the anecdotes of people who are being harmed, of families that are being torn asunder, but I don't think that it was look at the dollars that we're losing.
Because why? We've got all these, we've got plenty of investments, we'll be fine. The tithing part doesn't matter so much anymore?
Well, you've got a financial base there that I think is very strong and very stable. Hmm. And whatever fluctuations there might be to the financial bottom line, I think would be minimal.
Troy Williams?
But when you have more and more people walking out the door, abandoning their faith, when you have families that either are being torn apart or are leaving the church en masse rather than just throwing their kids out, which is what they used to do. These are things that have an effect at a high level. You can't ignore them forever.
Troy Williams, does it matter to you the motive? At least they did it?
It's important that they did it. And yes, it is. And I hope, I mean, and President Oakes did seem to acknowledge that this was having an adverse impact on families. And I know many families who have gone and chatted with him. I think back at my own family and my own experience, when I first came out, and I had my first boyfriend, Rob, and he was this beautiful, amazing human, and I was in that euphoric space of love, first love. And my parents came to town, and they said, Troy, we want to see you. We don't want you to bring your friend. That moment forever altered my relationship with my parents, who have both passed away. They passed away without me being close to them. A version of that story reverberates all throughout the LGBTQ LDS population. All of our relationships have been damaged and harmed with our families. And that's why the pain is so acute and why a reversal of policy doesn't quite heal the wounds.
Another of Kate Kelly's tweets yesterday called this a self-serving reversal, and that it's, she said, too little, too late. I want to talk about this idea that it's too little. Does this really change anything if you're a gay Latter-day Saint? Troy Williams, you first. It's still transgression. It's still sin. You can be gay, but if you have sex,
right.
Or as you put it, if you do gay,
you can be gay, but you can't do gay.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The good thing within the family structure, perhaps now, a Latter-day Saint parent can attend their gay child's wedding without the fear that, oh my gosh, my child's becoming an apostate, and that can help bring and unite families together. So on that element, that could have a big impact. But still, if a gay Latter-day Saint or a transgender Latter-day Saint follows their impulse to love, their impulse to be authentic to how God created them, if they follow that impulse, they will be exiled from the faith community that has nurtured them from childhood, and that can be catastrophic.
Lee Hale, what do you think about that question about whether or not this is, I mean, because in some ways, if you're a child of a same-sex couple, then yes, your life materially will change. But again, if you're a same-sex couple in the LDS church, it won't really. I mean, you're not called an apostate, but I'm not sure what difference that makes to a lot of people.
When this policy was intact for the last, I guess, 3.5 years, the stories and the anecdotes I heard were less about the policy actually being enacted in people's lives specifically. There were those stories, but it was the tone. It was the weight. It was the overall feeling. And kind of what Greg was speaking to earlier, people do vote with their feet. But also you have to remember, the Mormons are missionaries, okay? This is a church where you preach your gospel. And in a sense, Latter-day Saints are validated. You know, the truthfulness of their word is validated by it being accepted by others. And I can imagine this has been a very tough sell for these missionaries all around the world. I know, Troy, you served in the UK, right?
Yeah, I did.
And I think you said in Twitter, like, you outed yourself on the BBC to everyone you taught.
That's right. Yeah, I did.
But, I mean, maybe, Troy, you can relate to that as a return missionary, the fact that I think the church leaders also want people to be baptized and to join. And if this was holding that back, that would be another reason.
Yeah, you know, everybody has an LGBT person in their life that they love. At the end of the day, it's a child, it's a cousin, a nephew, a friend, coworker, and this is just has been so inconsistent. And I want to tell a little story about my father, since I just kind of like talked about how my relationship was damaged with them. But 2 years ago, my father died, and on his 80th birthday, I sat down with him, knowing it was the last time that we would ever be together. And my father was so uncomfortable and so in pain over this issue. My father, my entire life, never brought up the issue of me being gay.
Orthodox Latter-day Saint.
Yeah, Orthodox Latter-day Saint. Yep. Never would be critical of the church. If someone talked about me being gay, he would change the subject. Yeah. Imagine having a gay activist son who's the leader of Equality
Imagine
Utah.
Imagine having you
yeah,
as a son.
Right. And he could never bring it up.
Yeah.
On his 80th birthday, we were sitting together for our last time. And he had the 80s TV show MacGyver on really loud. And MacGyver was saving the world from a nuclear meltdown with a candy wrapper.
Right.
And my dad picked up the remote on the commercial and he brought the volume down. And for the first time in our relationship, he brought up the issue. And he said, "Did you hear about the policy of children of same-sex parents?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Heavenly Father didn't do that. Heavenly Father didn't do that." And as I tried to have a follow-up comment with him, he picked up the remote, turned the volume up really loud, and that was the last and the only time we ever discussed me being gay that he brought up. And that was powerful. My dad never would be critical of the church, but this was so difficult for him. And this was his way of sort of reaching out to me and trying to make amends, you know, 2 months before he died.
Yeah. Here's something from David Bakavoy, who wrote a response. He wrote, "I cannot join in your celebrations at this point. The policy devastated my family. I'm pleased the immoral policy is no more, but until we are offered a sincere apology from those who put this in place, I will retain my anger." And I wanted to ask all of you, to the question of whether it's too late, you know, the too little too late part that Kate Kelly was mentioning, I suppose there's some reason to believe that the original policy caused so much irreparable harm that some of this cannot be undone, that it showed leaders as callous and rigid and out of touch. And for some Latter-day Saints teetering on the edge, it showed that maybe they weren't in tune with the mind of God. Troy, what do you think?
You know, if I didn't believe that humanity could open their hearts and change hearts and minds, I would not be a LGBTQ activist in Utah. I believe that in this divine plan, however you experience God or whatever, I believe God has put LGBTQ children into LDS families to teach us all that we can love more than we knew we could. And I believe in the capacity. I've seen Latter-day Saints' hearts open up and embrace and love us with such passion. So I believe in the best of humanity.
Lee Hale, do you think it's too late in some ways? Do you think there was so much harm that you can't turn back, at least for some?
I mean, in some ways that has to be true. How can you undo that harm, especially if there's a loss of life or just just pain to a family and ended relationships? But it reminds me of the weirdest day as a religion reporter I've ever had was last spring. There was that fake apology that somebody wrote on behalf of church leaders, and this was with regard to the anniversary of the 78 revelation, giving black members entrance to the temple and the priesthood. Those are different topics, but what we got to see play out in real time was how members of the church would respond to an apology. And
they were excited.
They were ecstatic. And I was surprised at the spectrum of people that were excited. People that were very, very orthodox were ecstatic. And so I don't know if Nelson and Oaks will ever be the ones to make an apology, but I think if that happens in the future, I think that there is no end to the good that that could possibly do.
Greg Prince, we've got about a minute left. Too late, do you think?
History says that for those who left, it's too late. We'll never get them back. But looking forward, there are LGBTQ people who consider Mormonism their tribe, who want to be part of it. I was on the board of directors of Affirmation for 5 years, and the main thing that we were trying to accomplish with the church was a guarantee that gay members who wanted to come and worship could do so in safety. We didn't get that, and the policy drove a wedge right through the middle of that hope. That wedge has been removed now, and I think we're in a better place than we were pre-policy, because there is an implicit acknowledgement that, yes, this is a legitimate state of being, and we welcome you to worship. So we don't have full citizenship yet, and we want that, but we have moved the needle a bit, and it's a significant bit.
That's Gregory Prince. His new book is Gay Rights in the Mormon Church, Intended Actions, Unintended Consequences. Joined us today from Radio Dixie on the campus of Dixie State University. Gregory Prince, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Doug.
Troy Williams, Executive Director of Equality Utah, thanks for giving up part of your vacation and coming in.
Grateful. Thank you.
Thanks very much. And Lee Hale is in Boston working on a new religion podcast for KUER. Glad you took the time, Lee. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug. I'll be back on Monday.
Good. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction today from Michael Havey, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.